Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first part of Focus 580, we will be talking about Indonesia. And we are pleased and honored to have with us as the guest this morning, Sujanan Parnahadiningrat. He is the ambassador to the United States from the Republic of Indonesia. He is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, spending some time, and will talk with us. Just a bit of background about him. He has been ambassador to the U.S. since January of 2006. He joined the Foreign Service in 1981 and has served multilateral postings in a number of places, including Geneva, Vienna, and New York. He most recently held the post of Secretary General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, serving at the same time as the Indian Senior Official Meeting Leader to ASEAN, that's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. We're pleased, as I said, to have him here in the studio with us. And as we talk, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief in their comments and questions, and the only reason that we ask that is simply so that we can keep the program moving along and accommodate as many different people as possible. But certainly anyone who is listening should feel welcome to call and join the conversation. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana. In fact, even if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that number. That is 800-222-9455. And then here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you. I'm so delighted to be with you.
Parts of Indonesia, as well as other countries, were devastated by a tsunami in 2004. People will recall. And not just, Indonesia was most affected, but also there were people who were killed in Sri Lanka, in India, in Thailand, in Africa.
That's true.
Yeah. Now, it's been a little over 3 years.
Almost 2 years and a half, actually.
And so what I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about is the extent to which rebuilding and recovery has occurred. And certainly we must say that people whose lives were touched by this will, in a sense, there are people who will never truly recover, who lost family, who lost their homes. But having said that, would you say that the nation has indeed recovered and rebuilt?
Well, before I begin, I really have to once again say or express our gratitude to the American people who, during the hardship that made our people in Aceh suffered from the tsunami, helped a lot by American people, the American government, and all those. Talking about what have been done since the tsunami has stricken us, stricken Aceh, I think I would like to put it in this perspective. Say, for instance, we have a five-year plan to rebuild the devastated area. If we put 5 years and you know 2 years and a half already, probably I can put the rehabilitations, recovery, reconstructions of the areas has come to around 50 to 60%. As a illustration, I would like to point out some figures of what people have done with the help, once again, with the help of different kind of international agencies, different kind of non-governmental organizations from all over the world. Let me cite the figure. Around 1,200 schools that we need to build. We have already built around 700 and even more. This is a figure of 6 months ago. So if we are talking about 1,200 schools that we need to build, we have already built around 700 plus. And out of 400 medical facilities that we need to build, that we found is destructed by the tsunami, 400 medical facilities, we already been able to build around 150 or 160 of them. And now houses, there are around 130,000 houses that was devastated, that was destroyed by the incident. And out of this 130,000, we have built approximately 80,000 houses been built. And over 400 kilometers a road that have been built, out of 1,300 kilometers that we need to build and to reconstruct. So this, I think, the figure that is very encouraging to us. And once again, this is thanks to the cooperation, the help of people from all the world, and also, of course, some fund that also been provided by our government.
Yeah. So, as you say, 2.5 years. My math skills are a little bit off there.
Yeah.
So, in figuring that. So, 2.5 years, halfway through, what you anticipate would be at least a 5-year effort of rebuilding.
Yes.
One of the concerns, I think, was I'm sure that when something like this happens, there are generous pledges of aid that come in from many places, which is a wonderful thing to see.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, that promises aren't always fulfilled. Of the money that was pledged,
yes,
how much of that actually did end up being coming to your country?
Well, it's hard for me to get into an exact figure, but you see, we established a agency for reconstructions and rehabilitation of Aceh. This agency is specially built for this purpose, and this is the one that have all the figure. But as I have already picked up and illustrate in our conversations of number of facilities that we built, this have shown that indeed the pledge, at least pledge that had been made during the incident, somewhat have been materialized. As you see with the building of facilities that I have mentioned, and I involved myself during the first day of the handling of the problems. I vividly remember when only 2 or 3 weeks after the tsunami, we received hundreds of millions of dollars. And we received also not only pledge, but check or cash that already been made available by a number of countries. No, there are around 7 billion that already been pledged. And out of these 7 billion, there are among 6.1 billion that already been dispersed and managed by the Agency for Aceh Reconstruction and Rehabilitation. So out of 7 billion, there were around 6.1 billion. And I think it's a good number.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of the things that I have read about is that there is a plan in place that, and it's being put in place now to build a warning system.
Oh, yes.
That would give people some kind of heads up that such a thing was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's my understanding that it is supposed to be completed by 2009, but that some of these warning stations are already in place. And there is some concern, I think, about how it is that the information gets to the people who are likely to be affected. And I believe that, in fact, there was a tsunami that struck the coast of Java last summer, and several hundred people were killed.
Yep.
And
yep.
There apparently was some confusion of the people there about whether or not there was a threat or not. And that there seems to be this big question about, if the warning system produces a warning and then that information goes to the government, then how is it that the government then gets that information to the people who were there in the way of the tsunami?
That's true. Well, indeed, this is not an easy task for the government to right away inform people around of what is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But with the equipment that been installed, especially surrounding the place where in 2006 we were hit by tsunami. We have been able to put in place the system. For instance, we have a number of radio stations, television stations that been put in the system whenever there is a warning that something is going to happen, then this will be disseminated to the people around the place where is anticipated tsunami is going to strike. Once again, it is not an easy task because the remoteness of of areas, the road and all those infrastructure, that is not as good as we have expected. So, but at least we have put in place. We have the system, and we it is only a matter of how to disseminate the information as quick and as fast as possible. So this is one thing that is not easy because people spread over the area. They live not their daily life not being connected with telephone facilities, for instance, and this I think indeed a problem that we are facing in terms of how to as expedite as possible inform people to prepare of something is going to happen.
Yeah. Well, let me again just very quickly reintroduce our guest, Janan Pranahadiningrat. He is the ambassador to the United States from the Republic of Indonesia, and he is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We're pleased to have him here on the program. And for people who have questions, they are certainly welcome. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Indonesia, I understand, is, I think, working to, in a sense, solidify its position within the region in the sense that it is improving, for example, it is improving relations with some of its nearest neighbors. Most recently, it signed an important agreement with the government of Singapore. Mm-hmm. And not very long ago, I think it renewed its security agreement with Australia.
Yes, we did.
So those are two of the closest neighbors to Indonesia.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that the government is raising its status, in a sense, and becoming more and more important, I think, in the security apparatus and in this part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about how you see Indonesia fitting in to simply the politics and the nations of that region, of your neighborhood?
Well, we basically implement what we named as active, free and active foreign policy. With that terminology, we try as best as we can to contribute to the building of peace and stability in the region. We try as best as we can to contribute into establishing a well-being in terms of relations among countries in the region. And one of the pillars of our foreign policy is with the ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations,
mm-hmm.
where we take an active part to strengthen ASEAN as the organization for 10 countries in Southeast Asia. With the inclusions of the last members of ASEAN, Laos, Cambodia, and Myanmar, we became 10 countries. And the fact that we are the largest countries in the ASEAN, we have 230 million population back there, and the fact that the stable relations with our neighbor will contribute largely to the stability in the regions, we try our best to come up with different kind of concept. The one that we are proud about is when in 2003, the ASEAN adopted what we called as ASEAN community concept. ASEAN community concept that rests on three pillars. There is ASEAN security community, ASEAN Economic Community, and then the third is ASEAN Social and Cultural Community. We are trying to build the community of nations of 10 countries with these three pillars. And Indonesia is the one that have drafted and have come up with the ASEAN Security Community concept. With this concept, we offer a platform for 10 countries to work closely together, not only in among the 10 countries, but also with the neighboring countries. The two agreements that we have just signed, first with Australia, which was signed in Lombok a few months ago, I think is one of the evidence that we try to engage countries, neighboring countries, in our effort to establish this stable and a secure environment in Asia. And also the agreement between Indonesia and Singapore recently was meant to contribute into the building of this community in Southeast Asia. So being the largest country in terms of populations, being a country which for its own merit we have a role that we thought we can play, in many occasions come up with different kind of concept. This is the way we try to play our role in the region.
Well, certainly, as you say, it would be appropriate for Indonesia to have a role given its size, particularly in terms of population, but also just in terms of land mass. One wonders why it hasn't happened before now. And do you think that this is somehow linked to greater progress toward democracy? And I think one thing we should note, in fact, that in 2004, this was the first ever in the history of the country, the first ever direct presidential elections in which Mr. Yudhoyono was elected president. Is that, do you think, important to where it is the country is now, particularly in how it sees itself in terms of leadership in the region?
Yes, well, you pointed out correctly on the situation in terms of the way we are trying to make a contribution to what I've elaborated. In 1997, we were stricken by the economic crisis, by the financial crisis, as you may notice. From early 1990s until 1997, we grew at the level of around 7 to 8% per year. And then 97 up to 99, our economy contracted to minus 13. So you cannot expect a country with the economy which contracted to minus 13 to do anything in terms of contributing into the establishment of peace and security in the region. And as of 2003, we enjoyed somewhat better economic growth, that we grew at the level of around 4.5, 4.6. In 2005, we grew around 5.6, 5.7. Last year, we grew at the level of around 6. And we tried to grow our economy to a level of around 6%. This is the first. So when we have the economy growth, of course, we have the resources to do things. Secondly, when you mentioned also that in 2004, we were able to hold the first ever in history, the election to elect directly our president. And with that, we are very confident that being a newly born democracy, we can do much about contributing to the establishment of peace and security in the region. So first is because of the economic situations that we enjoyed within these last 2-3 years. And then second is the ability of our people to perform elections, that can, with that we can show that we will turn into a full democracy, and that we are confident that we can do something about it. Mm-hmm.
It was certainly remarkable that, and it says something, I'm sure, about the depth of discontent of the people back in the late 90s after the economic crash,
that
people were so unhappy that it brought about a change of government. The man, General Suharto, who had been the leader of the country for quite a long time at that point.
30 years, 32 years.
He was literally driven out of office because people were so unhappy about the country's economic state. Now we're back to, what, about 5.5-6%?
Yes, around 6%.
Growth, like that.
Yes.
So now are people satisfied with that level of growth?
Well, you see, democracy bring about freedom. Everybody is no free to speak. And of course, there is no government that can fully satisfy 100% of their people's needs. So we are trying our best to fulfill the responsibility of bringing the people to a level of welfare and well-being that will satisfy everybody. But certainly many more things to do for the government and together with our people.
Certainly, one of the facts of life, I'm sure, about Indonesia is that it is one of those places where there is a great gulf between people who are doing really well and people who are not, because certainly there are people who are wealthy and who
correct.
Are very
That's
successful and who are prosperous. And then
That's
there
correct.
Are people who, if, for example, it's been the figure. One of the figures that I saw is that 49% of the people of Indonesia live on less than $2 a day, U.S. So obviously there's a big gulf.
Sure. You see, we have a population of about 230 or 225 million. So around, your figure that you just went out is somewhat, debatable. But if you speak about $2 a day for Indonesian people to live, well, of course, this is a very, very small amount. But for those who live in the countryside, of course, they need to be given a better chance to live. But with this $2 a day, they can live. Yes, but at the same time, we are trying, once again, our best to improve the situation.
Yeah. Well, certainly it is a place marked by remarkable diversity in terms of levels of development, where people are in terms of culture. I don't know how it is that one goes about forging the idea of some sort of national identity when you have a place where there are people who speak more than 300 languages.
Oh, yes, you do. Yes. Well, we have the nation philosophy, the state platform that we have adopted since from the inception of the country that we called as five basic principles, Pancasila, for which people adhere into this principle, and with that we build our nations from the independence that we gained from the colonial occupations in 1945. And through the time, it has been the litmus test for this nation to live, to be bound together as a nation. And through a number of periods of hardship, we were able to, still being together until today, and we're proud of being one nation. So, without, of course, without seeing that, there has been indeed a problem that we encountered in the past, but still we are being one nation, that is Indonesia.
Well, in this part of Focus 580, we're talking with Sujanan Parno Hadiningrat. He is the ambassador to the United States from the Republic of Indonesia, and he is spending some time here on the campus of the University of Illinois. We're pleased that he could be here and to talk with us. Just again, let me tell you very quickly some of his background. He's been involved in the foreign service of his country since 1981. He became ambassador to the United States in January of 2006. He has had a number of positions in the foreign service in Geneva, in Vienna, and in New York. Most recently, he held the post of Secretary General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and at the same time, he served as the Indonesian senior official meeting leader to ASEAN, that's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And we'd be very happy to take calls. In fact, we have someone we're going to do in just a moment. First, however, as it is the first Tuesday of the month, we must pause and do this. This is a test of the emergency alert system, only a test.
provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
This is AM 580, WILL Urbana, and Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And again, our guest is Sujatnan Parnahadiningrat. He is ambassador to the U.S. from the Republic of Indonesia. Questions welcome. We do have somebody here ready to go in Champaign County, here where we are, on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You were speaking of the general's era. It prompted me to remember, and I think this is true. I'm not in front of my computer, so I haven't Googled it, but the beleaguered Wolfowitz was the ambassador to Indonesia at that time. Maybe you've been in the service that long that you remember that era when the U.S. was sort of apologizing for the general. But I actually was prompted to call originally by this legal case against in the Indonesian courts against the corporation called Freeport-McMoRan. Some people call it a good example of state capture by a corporation, I think, because of the amount of mining that is done by this company. I know you're a diplomat. I know that a lot of Indonesians also still have the habit of not wanting to speak out. So you may have a different personal view than your governmental view, but it seems to me that the if the law doesn't prevent what they're doing, then the law needs to be changed. A lot of people were really devastated by the practices of this corporation, and there's still activists that are working on the issue. And I don't know what you can say about it, but it seems to me that it's a good example of continued exploitation by the first world against the lesser developed countries. And again, I kind of wanted to raise it with the audience because it had been in the news just recently, and this corporation is actually pretty much of a scoundrel corporation around the world, not just in Indonesia. And we who are benefiting perhaps somewhat indirectly, maybe the stockholders will rise to its defense. But I just wanted to raise that and get you to say what you mind about the. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And this is, in case people have not heard this story, this is a case of a company that had a large American mining company, Newmont Mining, and was charged with polluting the waters in the area where it had a gold mine. And there was a trial that took almost 2 years. And according to the latest story I think I have is that they were found not guilty of the charges of polluting. This is Buyat Bay. This is off the island of Sulawesi. And the chief prosecutor said that the verdict would be appealed. So anything that you would want to say about that?
Yes. Well, first when I heard one of the audience spoke on the telephone, I thought we were talking about Freeport, and now we're talking about a new one, two different cases.
Well, okay. Now I'm confused. This is the one that I'm familiar with that has indeed
the verdict out already, yes.
Recently, yeah.
Yes, the verdict for Newmont is out, given to the Indonesian president of Newmont that he is now free and is being appealed. Hmm. This is a one of the example on how the scientific evidence of the pollutions has been put in the context of providing hard evidence in the case in the court. That if I'm not mistaken, there were around six laboratories that were employed to try to seek the truth whether this company polluted the sea around their operations or not. And out of these six laboratories, there were one which said that the company has polluted the environment, and the other five have provided in very hard evidence that they did not pollute. So the court then take decision based on this hard evidence. And I thought it is with all fairness that is based on the scientific examinations of the sample, then the court work based on this evidence. And I think even though it's going to be appealed, we certainly have our confidence on the fully functioning of the court first, and have all of our confidence based on the scientific observations, scientific examinations of the water around the operations of Newmont. So it is very much up to the court to take decision when it is going to be in the appealed court. Now, talking about Freeport, with the dynamic of democracy in Indonesia, when where everybody have free to speak, free to make their observations, their opinions on anything that is going on in terms of the operations of foreign companies, I think this dynamic has come to a level that have made Freeport give better treatment to people in Indonesia, and especially those who live around the pit mining. And the fact that we have entered into a long-term contract with Freeport, of course, the sanctity of the contract have to be observed by both sides, but at the same time, the dynamic of the demand of the people have also been satisfied by the government as well as the company. So we are working very closely with Freeport to address issues that arise from their operations. First, based on the contract that we have signed. Second, based on the demand by the people around the operations of the mining. So to strike the balance between the need to observe the sanctity of the contract and to fulfill the interests of people.
As we have mentioned a little bit, Indonesia is a very large country. We have, by population, it's the fourth most populous country in the world, over 200 million people.
Yes, yeah.
And they are spread out among more than 17,000 islands. So we're covering a lot of territory here, and so we have a lot of different people, a lot of different cultures, a lot of different languages. And one of the stresses on the country, on Indonesia, is that there are various places where people, at the very least, are looking for greater autonomy, and at most are looking for independence. One of these places is the province of Aceh, which was the place that sustained so much damage from the tsunami. After that, that actually, if you can say it this way, there was something at least a tiny bit positive about that, because it brought the two sides, the Indonesian government and the rebels that had been fighting so long for independence, it brought them to the table to say, look, we've got to stop. If we're going to hope to rebuild after the tsunami, we've got to achieve some kind of agreement. So there in fact was a peace agreement that was signed and came into effect in 2005. Last year there were elections there. A former leader of the Free Aceh Movement became the governor, and at least at the moment it seems that the people that had been asking for so long for independence have said, well, for the moment, we would settle for greater autonomy, but I think that they have not given up on the idea of independence. What do you think is likely over time to happen in Aceh?
Well, of course, we are working on how to solidify the implementations of the Helsinki agreements 2005. Mm-hmm. Note the fact that the former leader of the Aceh Ripple has become the governor, and it is only for him to prove what he in the past have been struggling for. That in many cases, people like the government who was a former Ripple aspiring to give a better life, better welfare and well-being for the Chinese people, and it's for him to prove. And at the same time, when we observe the provisions of the agreement, there is nothing in the agreement that and in the future give Aceh an independence, meaning that we have all of our confidence that Aceh is going to be still with us in the long term, and know that the governor who is formidable has been given a chance to prove that he can work to satisfy the need of the people, then we can be very sure that there will be a good future for Acehnese being part of Indonesia, which is which has the leadership of a former rebel to lead the development in the area. So if I have to ask to answer the questions of what is going on in the future, we are very confident that Aceh is still going to be with us, and at the same time, we are trying our best to, in the context of given autonomy to that region, to work together with Acehnese people to, be still part of Indonesia in the long term.
Mm. I'm sure that the people in Aceh and other places in Indonesia look to the example of Timor, East Timor, as being something that perhaps is somewhat encouraging, because after a long period of occupation by the government of Indonesia, eventually Timor became independent. Now, things have not gone well there since independence. That's another question. But they at least see that eventually, after a long time and a long struggle, the government did indeed grant independence. And I would expect that, I expect that in Aceh and other places, there are people who would say, this may take a long time, but we're going to continue this fight one way or another in the hope that eventually that goal would be achieved. I mean, how does the government think about that?
Well, East Timor is a special case. East Timor is from the very beginning, not part of Indonesia by any standard, actually. In terms of the recognition by the international community of the status of East Timor being part of Indonesia is questionable. So, since from the very beginning, from historical point of view, from legal international legal point of view, East Timor was not part of Indonesia. But if you see all the areas, all the territory that now been called as the territory of Indonesia is or was in the past a territory of the colonial master. So once the colonial government have granted the sovereignty to Indonesia as a country, then the territory that in the past was the territory of the colonial then become part of Indonesia. So this is one of the basic principles in, as I know, in terms of international law, how to establish a territory of a certain country. Then Indonesia has all the territory that is in the past was Dutch colonial territory. So, talking about the future of different kind of aspirations for independence and for greater autonomy, we have we have promulgated two laws in 2002 and amended in 2004 for us to conduct devolutions for 33 provinces in Indonesia to run their governmental system in full autonomy, and with which we believe that while still living together as part of Indonesia, they have a greater chances to develop with their own way for the 33 provinces. And with this autonomy law, we believe that each of the provinces can develop can hold a development programs that will satisfy their people while still being part of Indonesia. Of course, it is not easy to predict what is going to happen in, say, 10 or 20 years to come, but with the notion that we have been one nation, and nation building, although it's a continuous process, but been successful within this last 56 years since 1949, 58 years. We have been fully independent in terms of we've been granted this sovereignty in 1949, although we independence in 45. And since we have been successfully in around 57 years to become one nation, with all the challenges that have been faced in the past, we are confident that we're still being together.
Just very quickly here, and I promise I have some callers I want to get to. I'm just interested in anything that you might have to say about Timor. It became independent in 2002.
Yes.
And has really experienced a great deal of turmoil since.
Yes.
Do you have some feeling about what went wrong in Timor?
Well, I served in East Timor during the referendum preparations for them to hold the referendum, the popular consultation, we call it. I suspect that the cohesiveness in terms of relations among populations in East Timor that consists of different group of people, different ethnics, hasn't yet been achieved. The cohesion in terms of feeling to be one great nation, one nation. So this is a nation building process that I thought by the time they will be able to share their basic values that they can find, out in the years to come. 2 or 3 years since independence is very short for them to find this, element for them to share together. And I believe that gradually they will find one that they agree commonly, and then they use as a philosophy for their nation, and they can build their nation. Mm.
Well, we have a couple of callers here, and I want to get to them. So we'll do that, and we'll start here with somebody in Savoy, I believe, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Did I understand correctly that we have the Indonesian ambassador to the United States?
Yes, yes. Sir.
Well, that's superlative. I have two parts to my call.
Yes,
the first
yes.
part is, did I understand correctly that the government of Indonesia is content with the whatever working relationship it has with this company one of the callers mentioned, Freeport-McMoRan?
No, sir, not actually. We work very closely with them, and the contract that has been signed were observed very very carefully. Both sides, we implement the contract, and the revenue that is given by this company is since from the very beginning been included in the revenue of the republics, and we work very nicely with them.
Well, that's what I thought you were saying. So I think you just agreed with the premise of the first part of my call, and that is that the government of Indonesia does not have any particular complaint about Freeport.
Not in the part of the government, but of course, as I said in during one of my presentation, I said that with the dynamic of democracy in Indonesia, people are free to speak and whatever they want to speak, and with these situations, sometimes they face the demand of the people for them to. For the Freeport to give a better treatment to people around the place where this company operates.
All right. Well, of course, being a democratic approach to register their complaints, and do they have unions too?
They do, sir. Yes.
Yes. So then, there is no current cause of alarm. There is no need for the Indonesian government to step in. This is an employer-employee, an environmental
yes.
relationship that should be able to be handled locally.
They did recently, a month ago, probably even 3 weeks ago, they have just been able to settle the dispute between employers and employees for the employees to get better pay for them to work in the company.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that, and I thank you for being available to WLL today. I do happen to own some stock
in
Freeport.
Yes, yes.
I have read from time to time different things. Now, the second part of my call is about the original caller who brought this up. It's while I am not a daily listener to WLL, I do listen often enough that I can legitimately say that that caller calls in quite frequently, and that caller is almost on the negative theme, pro-socialism perhaps, always seeing problems in no matter who's doing what. I suspect, and this is just my suspicion, he's never claimed this, but I suspect that in the 1930s he would have been a devout communist, seeing that as the salvation of the universe. And I thank you for being available, and if David has time and there are not too many callers, I'd appreciate understanding a little more why you are with us today, and thank you for being here.
Well, we do have another caller that I want to get on to.
We're
fairly short on time. This is Bloomington Normal. I want to go there on our line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
As you know, Americans have provided generous aid to Indonesia.
You do.
And many of these generous Americans are Christians. I want to ask you about how Indonesia treats Christians. Militant Muslims in Indonesia have killed at least 8,000 Christians, and have destroyed 722 churches since 1996.
Please, please,
in central Sulawesi and in the Maluku Islands, where Christians are the majority, they have been subject to outright military attacks and killing. One year ago, May 2006, 7 Muslim militants confessed to the beheading of 3 Christian schoolgirls in central Sulawesi. They're schoolgirls. These Muslims caught them and beheaded them. We have a situation in which three Sunday school teachers, Christian Sunday school teachers, have been convicted of a crime called Christianization. What they did, they allowed Muslim children, with their parents' permission, to participate in a Sunday school party in a public park. Those three women, Dr. Rebecca Leontina, Ratna Bangoon, and Eti Pangusti, are now in prison. They are serving 3-year prison terms for the crime of Christianization.
We're getting very short on time here, and I want to make sure that our guest has an opportunity to respond.
I think it's a sad situation that because of misinformation, there is misunderstanding among and between us. Look at this figure, 3 Christian girls that you mentioned. One of them is Muslim. So that is nothing to do at all with religion's strife. That is nothing at all to do with religion's strife. Well, please, I beg your indulgence, sir, that this is misinformation that I think have made relations between us somewhat sour. 8,000 Christians were killed. Where and when? Never. Never because of the adherence to certain religions, people were killed in Indonesia. There has been a strife among a group of people, and they claim as if this is things to do with religions. But in fact, there are elements of ethnicity. There are elements of jealousy in terms of somebody getting a post in the government, and there is an element of banditry and all those. And people claim as if there has been religious strife, and you see. If you talk about a place in Poso, for instance, a few months ago, it was early February, our police have arrested around 29 people that are suspected of being the culprit of the conflict in Poso. And, it happened. This is not because of religion, but it happened to be that They are Muslim. So if you think that the government has done wrong to the religious follower, I think this is, I really have to beg your indulgence. It's wrong, completely wrong. Because, among the religious follower in Indonesia, we really have seen that the harmony among them has grown. Of course, there are one or two pockets of militants, one or two pockets of fundamentalists that works in Indonesia, that not only the Christians, but we are also the Muslim, which consists of 80% of Indonesian population, fight against those people which claim using religions to kill people. So we are very sad to be seen as a place where religious strife has happened. The fact was that we are struggling together. Muslim and Christians and all those religious followers are struggling together against terrorists. And terrorists are not those that observe a particular religion. They claim as if. I believe that there is no religion that teaches people to kill other people.
Hmm. It is a terrorism, obviously, is a concern for the government of Indonesia. There is concern about militant Islam. I was interested, you gave a speech to the National Press Club in which you said the government was interested in dealing with terror in a direct way, that is, going after terrorists, but also that you said that it was important in the long term to try to deal with the root causes. Just very quickly, what do you think the root causes of terrorism are?
Well, from one place to other places, different cause. In Indonesia, we can find that one of the cause is poverty. The chance to get a better life that is not been fulfilled. First and secondly is the infiltrations of people to Indonesia who teach, using violence to pursue certain objectives. Yeah. So against the violence and fighting against the violence, fighting against poverty is one two root causes of terrorism that we're fighting.
Forgive me for interrupting there, but I simply must because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Sujadnan Parnahadiningrat, he is ambassador to the United States from the Republic of Indonesia. He's visiting the campus here. Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador, for being
here. You're most welcome. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share with our audience in here on Indonesia.